welcome to this month's AstroPod. I'm Anna Quiter.
And I'm Maciek Hermanović.
So Maciek, it's been a while. How was your vacation?
Quite nice. I managed to do quite a bit of traveling around Europe. 5 trips with no travel cause disruptions, believe it or not.
I think that has to be a record.
Yeah, travel it safely. Take the train. Anyway, we are back after the holiday break, and we've got some more public outreach events lined up for this month.
Yeah, so we have our usual public observing on Wednesday nights here at the Institute of Astronomy, and this month, our very own Alex is going to be giving a talk.
Indeed, he's going to be talking about explosions in space. And another thing you might be interested in, dear listeners, is that the IOA has got its own Twitter account, which publicizes all our outreach activities. So go to Twitter and look for IOACOA.
Yeah, sounds great. So Maciek, one of the big stories that's happened while we've been offline is that they think they've discovered a way for life other than our type of life to exist in the universe?
Yes, basically early December, some scientists in the US announced finding arsenic-based life forms in Lake Mono in California. And this is quite a remarkable discovery because basically those bacteria managed to incorporate arsenic molecules into their bodies. So they're using one of the most poisonous substances available to actually make life out of it, which I believe is quite cool.
So did they actually find these bacteria like already having the arsenic in them as part of their fundamental structure, or was that something that they recreated in the lab?
This experiment has been recreated in a lab. So basically they were trying to poison those bacteria with arsenic, and they found out that instead of dying like your regular bacteria should, they started using arsenic to build their cells out of. And they strongly believe this also happens in situ in the lake.
Wow, that's crazy. But I've heard there's a lot of controversy. A lot of, you know, editorials have been written about this. And so where does sort of the state of things stand? Like, do we actually think that this is a real indication that non-carbon-based life form can exist?
It is very hard to say. As you've said, there's a lot of controversy. And those bacteria still use carbon.
Oh, they do.
They still use carbon within their cells. It's just they can also use arsenic to form some of the parts of their cells. And I guess the takeaway message is maybe they're not fully arsenic-based, but it tells us that life can be much more diverse than we are used to. And looking for life on other planets, eventually, we never really know what we're looking for.
Guess that can make it really hard to design experiments then, to find life on other planets.
True, which is exactly why we should aim to bring samples back from the surfaces of other planets to do some more extensive tests on them. Anyway, it's time for the news section, and because Laura is away this month, we're going to have a new host, Lauren.
Hi, I'm Lauren with this month's astronomy news. Kepler confirms the first rocky planet outside the solar system. At only 1.4 times the size of Earth, Kepler-10b is both the smallest planet yet discovered outside the solar system and the first that is certainly rocky. Taking a mere 20 hours to orbit its star at a distance 1/20th of that between Mercury and the Sun, this planet is very close to its parent star. "She's a scorched world," says Natalie Batalha, the leader of the science team that discovered the planet. At a temperature of 1,833 Kelvin, or 3,822 degrees Fahrenheit, Kepler-10b is not in the so-called habitable zone, the region around a star at which liquid water would be stable. The Kepler mission finds planets that orbit other stars, called extrasolar planets, by looking for the periodic dimming of a star that happens when the planet crosses in front of the star, blocking a small fraction of its light. The planet Kepler-10b blocks less than 5/10,000ths, or 0.05%, of its star's light. From its vantage in outer space, the Kepler telescope is capable of detecting this minute change in the star's brightness. Kepler is continuously monitoring over 100,000 sun-like stars, looking for this effect called a transit. Kepler is the first telescope sensitive to the transits of Earth-sized planets in front of sun-like stars. The planet Kepler-10b was confirmed from the Keck 10-meter telescope in Hawaii. The Keck telescope measured the motion of the parent star, which wobbles around due to the gravitational pull of the planet. From the motion of the star, the Kepler team was able to calculate the mass of the planet, a mere 4.56 Earth masses. With measurements of the mass and the size of the planet in hand, the team calculated the density of the planet. It is 8.8 grams per cubic centimeter, or about 1.5 times as dense as Earth, which means that its composition is somewhere between that of Earth and a planet of pure iron. Although Kepler-10b is the first confirmed rocky planet, other discoveries in recent years have revealed planets only a couple times larger than Earth. The planet GJ-1214b is 2.7 times the size of Earth and 6.6 times as massive. GJ-1214b is likely a water world, a planet made of mostly water with an atmosphere of water vapor. Another small planet, Corot-7b, has more in common with Kepler-10b. It is only 1.7 times the size of Earth, orbits its star in 20 hours, and orbits at a distance 1/20th of that between Mercury and the Sun. However, the errors in the measurement of the mass of Corot-7b are quite large, and so its composition could be anything from a rocky body like Earth to a planet of mostly water. Of these three known super-Earths, Kepler-10b is the smallest and the only one that is certainly rocky. The data that led to Kepler-10b's discovery took 8 months of continuous observation to collect. Kepler is scheduled to observe for at least 3 years, enabling the discovery of many more Earth-sized planets. 10-year-old girl discovers a supernova. Catherine Aurora Gray of New Brunswick, Canada, reported the discovery of a 17th magnitude supernova in the galaxy UGC 3378, which lies 240 million light years away in the constellation Camelopardalis last month. Catherine's father, amateur astronomer Paul Gray, and amateur astronomer David Lane confirmed Catherine's discovery. A supernova is the violent explosion of a massive star. Supernovae occur when massive stars, which fuse elements in their core to fight gravity, run out of fuel. Unable to support its weight, the star collapses inward, rebounds on its iron core, and explodes outward, dispersing heavy elements throughout the universe. A supernova typically releases enough energy to outshine its host galaxy. On New Year's Eve 2010, Catherine Gray and her father observed galaxy UGC 3378 from their home in Birdton, New Brunswick. 2 days later, when they examined the images from their New Year's Eve observations, Catherine found a bright dot near the galaxy that wasn't there in previous images. This dot was a supernova. Amateur astronomers Brian Tyeman and Jack Newton confirmed the supernova from Illinois and Arizona, respectively. Now designated supernova 2010 LT, Catherine's supernova holds the record of having the youngest discoverer in the history of supernova discoveries. And now, back to Anna and Maciek.
Thank you very much, Lauren.
So Maciek, I came across this interesting article about excavating minerals and other elements from the lunar surface.
Oh, I see. Was that plans to actually perform the excavations, or was that some more theory-based thing?
Yeah, so it turns out there are actually numerous companies that are looking into their legal rights to do mining on the lunar surface. And the reason this is awesome is because the moon, in recent experiments, that some of which we've talked about on this show, we've shown that the moon actually has a lot of water on its surface. And water, it turns out, can be split into its constituent oxygen and hydrogen, which is the basis for rocket fuel.
This is quite handy, because if you can produce fuel on the moon, then you can use it as a sort of refueling stop on the way to other locations.
That's true. In fact, that's one of the main arguments for why we'd like to go to the moon and why businessmen would like to go to the moon and start doing these mining operations. And the idea is that you could make rocket fuel on the moon and then ship it off to stations that are in low Earth orbit, so you could refuel different satellites or other spacecrafts in orbit.
Which is quite a sensible thing to do. I mean, most of the rocket weight at takeoff is fuel, and the less fuel you have to take with you off the surface of Earth, the better for you. So what's the legal position those people are in?
So as usual, bureaucracy stands in the way of innovation. And there's the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which says that the moon is going to be treated sort of like the oceans, where they don't belong to any one country, but countries can use them for fishing, or in the ocean case, or in the lunar case, for mining. But the problem is, if you're going to be investing billions and billions of dollars in setting up some sort of mining company on the moon, you kind of want to own the land that it's on so that you've protected your investment.
That is true. And another thing is, you should not believe the scam websites selling you some sort of deeds to lunar land patches or patches of land on Mars or whenever.
Right, because as I've said, you know, nobody can own those right now. Who knows, when we start exploring more of the solar system, maybe this will change, and maybe, you know, countries will start cutting up planets and the moon and stuff, kind of like we've done with Antarctica, but we'll see. I guess the future will show.
Right, then, before we start going out too far ahead into the future, let's move on to the history section. Here's Alex.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this month's AstroPod history section. Hanging on, as I am, to the festive spirit, I'm going to start with this question. What do you get an astronomer for Christmas? A nice telescope, perhaps, or maybe a new observing chair? I, however, would conjecture that the thing that delights every stargazer out there the most is a new astronomical survey. Now, an astronomical survey is exactly what it sounds like. A systematic cataloguing of objects in the sky at various different observing frequencies. These observations could consist of positions, distances, colours, motions, indeed a whole wealth of information. One of the earliest surveys was the noting down of positions and brightnesses of roughly 1,000 stars in the Almagest, a 2nd century work by Ptolemy of Alexandria. And this particular treatise is noted for its documenting of the work of the ancient Greek astronomer Hipparchus. Beside each star in the catalogue was placed a number, 1 indicating a particularly bright star, 2 being a star about half as bright, 3 being half as bright as 2, and so on. This logarithmic magnitude scale is still used by astronomers today, and is the root of the somewhat confusing convention that a higher magnitude object is fainter than a lower magnitude object. The Almagest was incorporated into the 10th century Book of Fixed Stars by the Islamic astronomer Al-Sofi. This book featured the first cataloguing of the Andromeda galaxy, described in the text as a little cloud, somewhere near the Arabic constellation the Great Fish, and the first recorded mention of the Large Magellanic Cloud. A satellite galaxy of the Milky Way also appears in this work. As observational technology advanced during the Renaissance in Europe, so the star atlases became vaster. During the 16th century, Danish astronomer Tycho recorded the positions of the stars with unprecedented detail, as well as making precision measurements of the motions of the planets. This survey provided Johannes Kepler with the data he needed to formulate his laws of planetary motion, which was subsequently used by Isaac Newton to derive his law of gravitation. In 1771, French astronomer Charles Messier noted down 110 cloud-like objects which were getting in the way of his search for comets, assigning a number to each. Unknowingly, Messier had observed wonderfully distant and exotic astronomical objects, including galaxies, globular clusters, and supernova remnants, far more exciting, in this broadcaster's opinion, than his beloved comets. Nowadays, advanced ground and space-based telescopes map millions of objects across the sky. The Hipparchus satellite obtained accurate positions, distances, and velocities of stars during the 1990s, and will soon be replaced by the upcoming European Space Agency satellite Gaia, to be launched in 2012. Infrared surveys were conducted by the TuMass project during the late 90s, which provided the first detailed study of very faint low-mass stars. The 2000s have seen the fruits of the Sloan Digital Skies Survey, a truly remarkable endeavour which has discovered vast numbers of extragalactic objects such as quasars and luminous galaxies, obtaining spectroscopic data for over a million sources and colours for hundreds of millions. These surveys are truly the lifeblood of modern astronomy, providing valuable data which helps us to understand what on Earth is going on out there.
Our guest this month is Professor Patrick Hall of York University, Canada. Hello.
Hello.
So the first question before we delve into your research interests is, what drove you into astronomy in the first place? Why choose this particular field?
Going quite a ways back, my father, when I was growing up, had a subscription to a science fiction magazine called Analog, which every month ran a science fact article. And when I was in high school, I read an article about particle physics. And I didn't understand all of it, but I was fascinated. So I knew then I wanted to do physics. And then I went off to university at Berkeley in California and studying physics, and I gradually found that astrophysics was to me the most interesting kind of physics. So then I went to graduate school in Arizona studying astronomy, and I've been lucky enough to stay in astronomy ever since.
Excellent. Now, looking back at your research career, you've been a survey astronomer. Your work has been dominated by survey interests. Why did you choose this particular aspect of astronomy?
Well, it was sort of what was available to me at the time. I was interested in quasars right from the start, and at Arizona there were two professors who had projects about quasars. One of them had already been snapped up by another grad student, and so I chose to join a, at the time, large survey to find new quasars. And once you've developed an ability to cope with survey data, I think it sort of puts you in a good position to take advantage of new surveys. That said, I'm no longer, I would say, at the forefront of using surveys. Some of the modern ones are extremely large and are very hard to manage individually. It takes a real team of people to really mine the databases successfully. But I still keep my hand in and enjoy looking at new large sets of data.
How could you describe what are the biggest challenges? What's the difference from your sort of standard observations when you go to this survey level? How is the work different?
Well, a lot of it is project management, both in the sense of what you would normally think in the business world, but also in terms of managing the data. Once the data starts coming in, you have to be able to reduce it to take care of any, peculiarities of the instrument used to obtain the data, and get it to a final form where astronomers like me can just download a catalog or an image that we can immediately start using to do science. So it takes a lot of work to do that. There's always things that you don't expect, and especially if you're a perfectionist, as many astronomers are, and you want to get the absolute most out of the data, then your first pass at analyzing it or reducing it is not the last. You keep finding new things to improve, and if you really want to do the best you can, it can take many iterations to converge.
So what would you say were some of the more exciting things you managed to find in those mountains of data?
Well, although my interest is mainly in quasars, I'm more generally interested in weird-looking spectra. So if you take an object and spread its light out into constituent wavelengths, constituent colors, and look at it, that can tell you a lot about the object. And there are some spectra which are extremely weird. And if you show me a spectrum and say, no one understands this, then I'm hooked. So one of the sorts of objects besides quasars that can have very weird spectra are white dwarfs. And we found an object in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which had been overlooked by everyone else, which turned out to be a white dwarf quite close to the sun and quite fast moving on the sky. The way we did this was we looked at all the spectra that had been classified unknown by the survey. Basically, the survey pipeline knows what a galaxy looks like, a quasar, a star, but if the spectrum is really weird, it sometimes just gives up and says this is unknown. So I actually had a high school student work for a summer at York University, going through and basically following a prescription to classify these spectra. And he found an object which looked like a star, it looked like a quasar in its spectrum, but it was moving across the sky very quickly. And it turns out that there was a problem with the spectrum. It wasn't a quasar emission line at all. It was just a white dwarf. And it's moving across the sky at almost 2 arcseconds per year, which is not very fast. Your eye can only see about 1 arcminute, stars 1 arcminute apart on the sky. But it's something like the 100th fastest or 150th fastest moving star that we know about. So that was overlooked until we trawled through the data and found it and figured out what it was.
Good job. Now, tell us a bit about the project that brings you here to the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge. What are you going to be working on during your stay here?
Well, the subject that brings me here is broad absorption line quasars. So these are a subset of quasars where there's a wind, so-called, of gas outflowing from the quasar that produces absorption in the spectra. So it's an interesting to me subset of quasars. And as I'm interested in the subject, when I was coming up on my sabbatical, I asked myself, who's doing the most interesting research on broad absorption line quasars? And to me, Paul Hewitt, a professor here at the Institute, is doing that research. So I had met him once before. I sent him an email, said, how about if I come out and we start collaborating? So in particular, he and his student, James Allen, are cataloging the Sloan Digital Sky Survey broad absorption line quasars using a method that I think is superior to what others, including myself, have done in the past. So once this catalog is available, there are many different applications that we can think of for it. I'm interested in understanding whether all quasars produce these winds, whether most of them do. That's probably the case, but why do some quasars show winds with very large velocity spreads and others only narrow velocity spreads? Basically understanding how the accretion disk of matter spiraling into the quasars can blow out large quantities of gas accelerated to high velocities, up to 10 or even 20% of the speed of light.
This is quite interesting because the generation of jets around black holes is not really a very well understood phenomenon yet, especially around the supermassive objects. So do you reckon your data will be able to give us some insight? Your research will be able to give us some more insight into those processes?
Not exactly, but in the sense that we can think of quasars, or more properly, the accretion disks around quasars, producing both jets and winds. So a jet, in this case, is a very narrow outflow of relativistic gas moving at essentially the speed of light, very highly ionized, and produces lots of radio emission, and we see radio loud quasars. And you're quite right. We don't really know how that works. We think it has to do with magnetic fields generated in the disk helping to collimate the outflow to keep it a narrow jet. But in other cases, we see outflows which seem to be less collimated, and we generally call those winds. They're probably not pressure-driven winds like we have in our own atmosphere on Earth. They're more likely radiatively driven by light pressure. So similar or more similar to the solar wind. I hope that the research that I'll be doing will shed some light on how winds work in quasars. But it's a really separate issue to know what the jets are doing. And that's more of a longer term project. I'm more interested in figuring out the winds in objects that don't show strong radio emission. And then maybe over time that will help us understand the jets in objects that do show strong radio emission.
Fair enough. Finally, what would you say is the scientific development you're looking forward to most over the next few years in astronomy or maybe outside it as well?
Interesting. There are lots of items which are exciting in astronomy. For my personal research, I'm part of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey Mark III to study broad absorption line quasars. So we're getting lots of repeat spectra. So objects where we know what the quasar looks like or looked like 5 or 10 years ago, we're getting another spectrum now. And it turns out there's a lot of variability in these outflows from quasars. And if you can see a quasar change its spectrum, that gives you some indication of the location of the gas around the quasar, which is something that we don't really know as much about as we'd like. So it's, I suppose, rather prosaic, but I'm really most interested in mining the databases that already exist and the ones that we're doing now. 10 years from now, there'll be a large synoptic survey telescope, which will image the entire visible sky roughly once a week. And I have some ideas of things you might do with that, but that's rather long-term. For the short-term, I'm really interested in using what we have now.
Excellent. Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, and good luck with your research.
Thanks, Pat and Maciek. So, hey, Maciek, so come across any other cool stories during our break?
Indeed, there has been a recent release of the largest astronomical picture ever done.
The largest? So do you mean largest in like the size of the sky that it's showing, or do you mean largest as in like the deepest image?
I mean largest as in the area of the sky it covers, because Sloan Digital Sky Survey has released a several terapixel image of essentially a mosaic of all its observations made from the beginning of 1998.
So I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around how big of an image that is. Can you tell me that in some sort of real scale?
Basically, if you take your average HD TV set, and if you wanted to use those to display this image at the standard resolution you're viewing TV in HD, you would need 500,000 of such TVs to show the whole of the image.
500,000 televisions.
Yes, indeed. It covers more than a quarter of the sky.
Wow, that's amazing. So what kinds of objects are they observing?
They're doing basically everything which you can see in the sky, starting with stars, galaxies, quasars, asteroids, you name it, it's there somewhere.
Wow, is there any scientific use to this image, or is it just like for the coolness factor?
Well, I would say this is definitely for the coolness factor, especially that I do not really believe many people have discs large enough to download something like that or have bandwidths to do it. But still, the sheer fact that we have something like that is quite a PR thing.
Well, I guess we'll know if we have a lot of listeners here at Cambridge if all of a sudden the bandwidth is all being used to go to the SDSS website.
I just hope it doesn't prevent any of you guys from downloading the AstroPod.
That's true. So now to tell us more about the night sky, here's Alex.
Up in the skies this month, Orion, one of the most popular and recognizable constellations in the Northern Hemisphere winter skies, stands proudly high in the southeast this month, making it a fantastic target for people who don't have access to any equipment. As well as the famous three bright stars that make up his belt, look to his shoulder on the top left to see the red giant star Betelgeuse. With a mass about 20 times that of the Sun and a radius over 1,000 times greater, it is one of the largest and most luminous stars known. Its red color comes from it being at a late stage in its life and is due to explode in a giant supernova within the next million years or so. By contrast, Orion's knee in the bottom right of the constellation is the star Rigel, a blue supergiant star and the most luminous star in our part of the Milky Way. Finally, Orion's sword, lying below the belt, seems to consist of three stars, although the middle of those appears slightly fuzzier than the other two. This is the Orion Nebula and is an active star-forming region, serving as a nursery to Orion's newest stars. Hopefully many of you caught the partial solar eclipse last month at sunrise on the 4th of January. It was seen by millions of people across Europe, Africa, and Asia. Weather prevented me from seeing it from Manchester, but hopefully some of you got to see a remarkable phenomenon of nature. Also at the end of last month, on the 19th of January, was a bright, clear full moon. In folklore, the January full moon is known as the wolf moon, from hungry wolf packs that would howl loudly at the moon near the villages of the Native Americans. And the full moon in the middle of this month is known as the ice moon. Finally, this time last year, Jupiter lost its south equatorial belt, the dark band in Jupiter's atmosphere. But since December, the band has started to reappear. This was likely due to atmospheric turbulence in the upper atmosphere, causing pale clouds of ammonia to be thrown high above the dark clouds that lie in the band. Keep an eye out over the next few months as the storms responsible for its disappearance calm down and the dark band reemerges. You can find it dominating bright in the southwestern sky after sunset. And that's it for the sky at night this month. Now back to Anna and Maciek.
Thank you very much, Alex.
So Maciek, to end the segment here, I just got to warn you about a dangerous monster lurking in thunderstorms.
Right. As in?
Okay, so maybe it's like not that bad. But very cool. Thunderstorms have been found to make antimatter.
Whoa. So basically, we're going to have some angels and demons-like scenarios floating around.
Well, first, for listeners who haven't read that book, let me explain what antimatter is. So basically what it is it's like regular matter, like electrons and protons, but with the opposite charge sign. So an electron has a negative charge, and a positron, the antimatter particle of an electron, has a positive charge. So in fact, on the topic of angels and demons, a few years ago, out of the blue, my mother calls me and says, "So honey, if you had some antimatter, how would you store it?" And I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, like, why is my mother calling and asking me about antimatter? Like, what is the world coming to? And it turns out that in that book, they have this whole catastrophe where they have this canister of antimatter that's been stolen. And so I explained to my mother how you could trap it with magnetic fields and things like that. So that's kind of interesting. You know, it was amazing to me that antimatter has made it into the popular mainstream consciousness at this point.
Indeed. I would say it's because it has one really cool property. If the antiparticle hits its corresponding particle, so if a positron hits an electron, they will annihilate.
In fact, that is exactly how they detected the antimatter in thunderstorms. So NASA has this thing called the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. And on this telescope, there is a gamma ray burst monitor. So what this detector does is it looks for huge, huge spikes in energy coming from around the Earth. And what they found is that there have been four extremely high energy events which could only be caused by a collision between matter and antimatter.
And I take it all four of those were in the regions associated with thunderstorms at that time.
Well, three were actually associated directly with thunderstorms, and the fourth one was far away from a really active thunderstorm. But what they think happened is that the thunderstorm made the antimatter particles, and those particles traveled up the magnetic field lines of the Earth and had an annihilation event with regular matter near the satellite, so the satellite could detect it.
That is quite cool. And by the way, if you're flying, don't worry, because there's just too much air in the way for the antimatter to get anywhere close to you.
So now here's Michelle with the joke.
Hi, Magic.
Hello, Michelle.
So are you ready for another amazing astronomy joke of the month?
Indeed I am.
This month, it's also in honour of the England cricket team's historic victory in the Ashes this
year. Oh, really?
Yeah, this month. So, drum roll please. What do you get if you cross a cricket ball with an alien?
I don't know. What do you get when you cross a cricket ball with an alien?
A bowling green!
That's quite good.
The cricket team will be proud of me.
I guess, I bet they will be. Thank you very much. And that's it for this month.
Normally, dear listeners, I would say see you next month, but this is actually my last AstroPod.
Yes, it's sad to see you leave, and thanks so much for everything you've done for the show over
yeah,
the years.
It's been awesome. You know, I've been a part of this for a few years, and I've really enjoyed it. So what I'll say to you, dear listeners, is if you want to know what I'm up to in the future, Google me.
Indeed, and don't forget to tune next month to listen to our brand new co-host.
Yes, our mystery co-host will keep the party going.
Goodbye.
See you later.